Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 622, titled More on the Nazi Origins of Islamic Fascism. This program is being recorded on January 27th of the year 2008. What we've been doing in this program is listening to a lecture, I'm reading the text of a lecture, by German author Matthias Kunzel, the author of the book Jihad and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. He was invited to give a lecture at the University of Leeds in October of 2007, and on October 10th of 2007, gave a lecture to more than 100 assembled academicians and students titled Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, The Impact of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the blogspot address or URL at which you can obtain this, the text of the lecture, will be, of course, included in the description for the record 622. What we've been examining is how the Muslim Brotherhood not only took some of the ideological/economic tenets of Nazism and incorporated those into an Islamic framework, but how also the Muslim Brotherhood and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, ultimately, by the way, not only a general in the Waffen-SS, but also the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement and a fellow who coalesced three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, one of which, the Hanjar division, was recapitulated in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. Al-Husseini and the Muslim Brotherhood, utilizing a Nazi radio station and the Middle Eastern folktale tradition, basically were able to recast anti-Semitism, a relatively minor element in some Islamic doctrine, to not only a central element of Islamic doctrine, but also casting the Jews as the oppressors or corruptors of Islam, rather than as simply an infidel people who had at one point been fallen beneath the sword under the order of Muhammad. And what we're going to continue with is this analysis by Matthias Kunzel. We're going to jump right back in to a section of Matthias Kunzel's lecture called Islamism and National Socialism. And we will jump back in, overlapping slightly with side one. What we have here is a new popularized form of Jew hatred based on the Oriental folktale tradition, which moves constantly back and forth between the 7th and 20th centuries. This kind of Jew hatred is used today by the British group Hizb-ut-Tahrir, by the way, linked with Bank al-Taqwa. In 2002, this organization reproduced a leaflet on its website saying, "The Jews are a people of slander, a treacherous people. They fabricate lies and twist words from their right context. Kill them wherever you find them," unquote. Classical Islamist literature had, as a rule, treated Muhammad's clash with the Jews of Medina as a minor episode in the Prophet's life. The anti-Jewish passages in the Quran and Hadith had lain dormant or were considered of little significance during previous centuries. These elements were now invested with new life and vigor. Now, the Mufti began to ascribe a truly cosmic significance to the allegedly hostile attitude of the Jewish tribes of Medina to the Prophet. Now, he picked out the occasional outbursts of hatred found in the Quran and Hadith and drummed them relentlessly into the minds of Muslims at every available opportunity, including via the Arabic shortwave radio station in Berlin. Radio Zaysin was a success not only in Cairo, it made an impact in Tehran as well. One of its regular listeners was a certain Ruhollah Khomeini. Later, of course, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was the founder of the Iranian Islamic Revolution in 1979, the forerunners of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And note that Khomeini's exile in France was financed by François Janoux. Janoux, a key Nazi financier, financed the defenses of Klaus Barbie and Adolf Eichmann. Janoux also financed a variety of Middle Eastern and far-leftist terror groups. François Genoux, also very close to the Banque Altaqua milieu. In the opinion of Ernest Bacchus, one of Europe's top experts on money laundering, when the money trail for 911 was traced back to its source, it would come back to Swiss France, founded by François Genoux. François Genoux, the heir to the political last will and testament and collective literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. Continuing now, with the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood Nazi propaganda, the Grand Mufti on then Ruhollah Khomeini in Tehran in the pre-World War II period, Radio Zaysan was a success not only in Cairo, it made an impact in Tehran as well. One of its regular listeners was a certain Ruhollah Khomeini. When in the winter of 1938, the 36-year-old Khomeini returned to the Iranian city of Qom from Iraq, he, quote, had brought with him a radio receiver set made by the British company Pi. The radio proved a good buy. Many mullahs would gather at his home, often on the terrace in the evenings, to listen to Radio Berlin and the BBC, unquote, writes his biographer Amir Tahiri. Even the German consulate in Tehran was surprised by the success of this propaganda. Quote, throughout the country, spiritual leaders are coming out and saying that, quote, that the 12th Imam has been sent into the world by God in the form of Adolf Hitler, unquote. We learned from a report to Berlin in February of 1941. So, quote, without any legation involvement, an increasingly effective form of propaganda has arisen which sees the Führer and Germany as the answer to every prayer. One way to promote this trend is to sharply emphasize Muhammad's struggle against the Jews in the olden days and that of the Führer today, unquote. While Khomeini was not a follower of Hitler, those years may well have shaped his anti-Jewish attitudes, which in turn would later shape the attitudes of his most ardent follower, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. To summarize, the historical record gives the lie to the assumption that Islamic anti-Semitism was triggered by Zionist or Israeli policies. In 1937, 11 years before the founding of Israel, Germany began to disseminate an Islamic anti-Semitism that fuses together the traditional Islamic view that the Jews are inferior with the European notion that they are deviously powerful. At one and the same time, we find the Jews being derided as pigs and apes, unquote, while simultaneously being demonized as the puppet masters of world politics. This specific form of anti-Semitism was broadcast to the Islamic world by Radio Zaysan. At the same time, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood was being subsidized by Nazi Germany, and its anti-Jewish agitation was being promoted. Radio Zaysan ceased operation in April of 1945. But why, 62 years later, do we find the combination of the swastika and the words "Kill all Jews" and "Allah" in Hempstead and elsewhere? This brings me on to my third and final point. The next section of the lecture is the second division of the world. After May 8, 1945, National Socialism was banned virtually throughout the Arab world. In the Arab world, however, Nazi ideology continued to reverberate. In her report on the 1961 trial of Adolf Eichmann, Hannah Arendt discussed the reactions to the trial in the Arab media. Quote, newspapers in Damascus and Beirut, in Cairo and Jordan, did not hide their sympathy for Eichmann or their regret that he, quote, had not finished the job, unquote. A broadcast from Cairo on the day the trial opened even injected a slightly anti-German note into its comments, complaining that there was not a single incident in which one German plane flew over one Jewish settlement and dropped one bomb on it throughout the last war, unquote. The heartfelt wish to see all Jews eliminated was also expressed in April of 2001 by the columnist Ahmed Raghab of Egypt's second-largest daily, the state-controlled Al-Akhbar. Quote, this is April of 2001 by the columnist Ahmed Raghab, and this is Egypt's second-largest daily, Al-Akhbar, controlled by the government. Quote, give thanks to Hitler. He took revenge on the Israelis in advance on behalf of the Palestinians. Our one complaint against him was that his revenge was not complete enough, unquote. Manifestly, following May 8, 1945, there occurred a twofold division of the world. The division in the political and economic system is well known as the Cold War. The second split, which was obscured by the Cold War, concerned the acceptance and continuing influence of National Socialist forms of thought. In November of 1945, just half a year after the end of the Third Reich, the Muslim Brothers carried out the worst anti-Jewish pogroms in Egypt's history when demonstrators attacked the Jewish quarters of Cairo on the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They ransacked houses and shops, attacked non-Muslims, and torched the synagogues. 6 people were killed and some 100 more injured. A few weeks later, the Islamist newspapers turned to a frontal attack against the Egyptian Jews, slandering them as Zionists, communists, capitalists, and bloodsuckers, as pimps and merchants of war, or, in general, as subversive elements within all states and societies, unquote, as Gudrun Kramer wrote in her study, The Jews in Egypt, 1914 through 1952. In 1946, the Brotherhood made sure that Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti, was granted asylum and a new lease on political life in Egypt. At that time, al-Husseini was being sought on war crime charges by, among others, Britain and the United States. Between 1941 and 1945, he had directed Muslim SS divisions in the Balkans and had been personally responsible for the fact that thousands of Jewish children who might otherwise have been saved got killed in the gas chambers. All this was known in 1946. Nonetheless, Britain and the United States chose to forego criminal prosecution of al-Husseini in order to avoid spoiling their relations with the Arab world. France, which was holding al-Husseini, deliberately let him get away. The years of Nazi Arabic language propaganda had made the Mufti by far the best-known political figure in the Arab and Islamic world. But the 1946 de facto amnesty by the Western powers enhanced the Mufti's prestige even more. The Arabs saw in this impunity, wrote Simon Wiesenthal in 1946, quote, not only a weakness of the Europeans, but also absolution for past and future occurrences. A man who is enemy number one of a powerful empire, and this empire cannot fend him off, by the way, that empire being Britain, seems to the Arabs to be a suitable leader, unquote. Now, the pro-Nazi past began to become a source of pride, not of shame, and Nazi criminals on the wanted list in Europe now flooded into the Arab world. When on June 10, 1946, the headlines of the world press announced the Mufti's escape, unquote, from France, quote, the Arab quarters of Jerusalem and all the Arab towns and villages were garlanded and beflagged, and the great man's portrait was to be seen everywhere, unquote, reported a contemporary observer. But the biggest cheerleaders for the Mufti were the Muslim Brothers, who at that time could mobilize 1 million people in Egypt alone. It was they, indeed, who had organized the Mufti's return from the start defended his Nazi activities from any criticism. In the following decades, large print runs of the most infamous libel of the Jews, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, were published at the behest of 2 well-known former members of the Muslim Brotherhood, Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar Sadat. By the way, of course, later both became presidents of Egypt. Continuing, both the Muslim Brothers' unconditional solidarity with al-Husseini and their anti-Jewish riots mere months after Auschwitz show that the Brotherhood did not object, to say the least, to Hitler's attempt to exterminate the Jews of Europe. The consequences of this attitude, this blindness to the international impact of the Holocaust, continue to affect the course of the Arab-Jewish conflict today. We see an expression of this in the continuing refusal of the Muslim Council of Britain, a British offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, to recognize the specific nature of the Holocaust and attend Holocaust Memorial Day events. How do Islamists explain international support for Israel in 1947? Ignoring the actual fate of the Jews during World War II, they revert to conspiracy theories, viewing the creation of the Jewish state as a Jewish-inspired attack by the United States and the Soviet Union on the Arab world. Accordingly, the Brotherhood, quote, considered the whole United Nations intervention to be an international plot carried out by the Americans, the Russians, and the British under the influence of Zionism, unquote. The mad notion of a worldwide Jewish conspiracy suppressed in Germany since May 8th of 1945 survived and flourished in the political culture of the Arab world. An especially striking example is the charter adopted in 1988 by the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine, better known as Hamas. In this charter, which, quote, sounds as if it were copied from the pages of Der Stürmer, as Sari Nasubeh, a former PLO representative in Jerusalem, has written, Hamas defines itself as, quote, the spearhead and the avant-garde, unquote, of the struggle against world Zionism, unquote. In the charter, the Jews are accused of being behind all the shocks of modernity. Quote, and this again, by the way, is from the Hamas charter. They aim at undermining societies, destroying values, corrupting consciousnesses, deteriorating character, and annihilating Islam. They are behind the drug trade and alcoholism in all its kinds so as to facilitate its control and expansion, unquote. In addition, they are held responsible for every major catastrophic event in modern history. The Jews, quote, were behind the French Revolution and the Communist Revolution. They were behind World War I. They were behind World War II, through which they made huge financial gains by trading in armaments and paved the way for the establishment of their state. There is no war going on anywhere without having their finger in it. Their plan, unquote, states Article 32 of the Charter, is embodied in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and their present conduct is the best proof of what we are saying, unquote. How can it be that the ardent supporters of Hamas, such as Azam Tamimi, who was a regular guest of the BBC and Channel 4, is never seriously challenged about the anti-Semitic content of the Charter? As in the 1930s and 1940s, the sheer absurdity of such claims makes it difficult for educated people to believe that anyone could take them seriously. Such claims nonetheless triggered pogroms in Russia, were used as the textbook for the Holocaust in Germany, and motivated the perpetrators of 9/11. I would interject, a lot of this very similar sort of attitude is very much present in the so-called 9/11 truth movement, which in many respects is an outright fascist political movement, which, ironically enough, experiences itself as being something of the opposite. But very similar overtones are to be found in much of the so-called 9/11 truth movement. Continuing. Islamic anti-Semitism is the reason why Hamas prioritizes weapons and war rather than peace and welfare. Islamic anti-Semitism is the reason why Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah recently warned Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries not to normalize relations with Israel, unquote. Islamic anti-Semitism is the only reason why Iran, a country that has neither a territorial dispute with Israel nor a Palestinian refugee problem, calls for the destruction of Israel again and again. Some observers claim that political concessions by Israel would be enough to stop anti-Jewish hate-mongering within the Arab Islamic world. They are wrong. For Islamists, the issue at stake is not the welfare of individual Palestinians, but the abolition of enlightenment, reason, and individual freedom, achievements whose spread is attributed primarily to the Jews. When even today Germans in Beirut, Damascus, and Amman are greeted with compliments for Adolf Hitler, this can hardly be Israel's doing. When graffiti in Hampstead Garden suburb combine swastikas with the word "kill all Jews" and Allah, what on earth has this to do with Zionism? Our historical excursion has, however, revealed that this combination is in no way accidental. The linkage of "kill all Jews," Allah, and the swastika indicates a specific ideology, one that is connected both historically and ideologically with Nazism and needs to be opposed with equal determination. Why, however, is it proving so difficult to mount such an effort, especially but not only here in Britain? Three suggestions as to why this might be. Firstly, this struggle, at least for the time being, has to be waged in opposition to a political left which has totally lost its moral compass and political bearings. It is true that Osama bin Laden has embedded this strategic goal of Talibanizing America and the world in a language that seeks to connect with Western protest movements and beyond that, put Islam in the place of the former communist system. Thus, in bin Laden's latest message of September 11, 2007, the fight against global warming is emphasized in order to attract the support of environmentalists. The anti-capitalist drum is banged, quote, you should liberate yourselves from the deception, shackles, and attrition of the capitalist system, unquote. And lastly, Noam Chomsky, the guru of the leftist anti-globalization struggle, is applauded. On the other hand, Osama bin Laden and every other Islamist entity such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Iranian regime do not hide their goal, the destruction of democratic societies and their replacement by a Sharia-based dictatorship. The American way of life constitutes, according to bin Laden's latest message, the greatest form of polytheism and is rebellion against obedience to Allah, unquote. It has to be replaced by Allah's rule. Total obedience must be to the orders and prohibitions of Allah alone in all aspects of life, unquote. And this is indeed the heart of the Islamist program, the accusation that granting people political and personal freedom amounts to heresy. The naivete, or malice, with which the political left has nevertheless yielded to the siren songs of Islamism is therefore frightening. Thus, in May of 2006, Noam Chomsky met the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and defended and praised Hezbollah's insistence on keeping its arms in defiance of United Nations decisions. Tariq Ramadan, an eloquent Islamist, has been given star treatment at European anti-globalization events. The Muslim Brotherhood's TV preacher, Sheikh Karadawi, gets invitations from the left-wing mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, while the Socialist Workers' Party has made the strategic decision to ally with a British offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Association of Britain, in building the Stop the War Coalition. Last summer, thousands of people were mobilized by this alliance to march through central London chanting, "We are all Hezbollah now," unquote. Of course, a left which brands Israel as abstractly evil, unquote, is not going to take Islamic anti-Semitism seriously. Demonizing Israel entails becoming deaf to anti-Semitism, or as Sigmund Freud put it, a participant in a delusion will not, of course, recognize it as such, unquote. Many Europeans assume that to draw attention to Islamic anti-Semitism is to play into the hands of racists. In Britain, multiculturalism has been the official civic religion for so long that any criticism of any minority group seems to have become the equivalent of profanity. Obviously, racism, discriminating against people on the grounds of their origin or skin color, must be combated. You can't be, however, multicultural and preach murderous loathing of Jews. In my opinion, we mustn't defend Jew hatred on spurious anti-racist grounds. We should rather distinguish between anti-Semites and non-anti-Semites within the Muslim communities. We mustn't advocate a crude top and bottom dichotomy in which the anti-Semitism of people from Muslim countries is excused as a kind of anti-imperialism of fools, unquote. We should rather insist that the struggle against discrimination become a universal one. Islamic anti-Semitism is a taboo subject even in some parts of academia. A story of intellectual betrayal and the corrupting influence of political commitment. Professor Peter van der Horst from the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands found this out when he proposed to give a lecture on the topic of the anti-Jewish blood libel. The head of the university asked him to excise the section of his lecture dealing with Islamic anti-Semitism. When he refused to do so, he was invited to appear before a panel of four professors who insisted he remove these passages. A lecture on Islamic anti-Semitism, so the argument went, might lead to violent reactions from well-organized Muslim student groups. Similar things have happened to me. When in April of 2003, I was invited by Yale University as keynote speaker on the topic of Islamic terrorism and anti-Semitism, the mission against modernity, unquote, there was such an outpouring of protest that the organizers changed the program. The original title of one of the panels, Islamic Jihad, a case of global non-state terrorism, was changed to Global Non-State Terrorism, unquote. In addition, a speaker was added to the podium whose sole qualification was that of being president of the local Palestine Right to Return Coalition, unquote. At least I was able to give my talk. Not so in March of 2007 at this university. Here, too, the term Islamic anti-Semitism stymied what should have been a lively debate already in March. Following emails by some Muslim students, my lecture title, Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, unquote, was changed to The Nazi Legacy, Export of Anti-Semitism into the Middle East, unquote. This proved to be a futile semantic gesture. On the day of my arrival in Leeds, the university administration canceled my talk on security grounds, unquote. No one, including the Muslim students, had threatened violence. As before in Utrecht, freedom of speech was suspended, in my opinion, by an act of preemptive self-censorship. Both university administrations probably believed that they were meeting the wishes of their numerous Muslim students in suspending a lecture about Islamic anti-Semitism. The erroneousness of this approach becomes clear when we realize that Muslims are criticizing Islamic anti-Semitism as well. Why do we hate the Jews? Asked Saudi columnist Hussein Shubakshi in a London-based Arabic daily in May of 2005. The extent of this tremendous hatred of the Jews is baffling. If we know the true reason why the Jews have become the reason for every catastrophe, then we will be able to understand the idea of dividing human beings into groups, unquote. In January of 2006, Tunisian philosopher Mezri Haddad complained that Arab public opinion, quote, has found in anti-Semitism the perfect catalyst for all its narcissistic wounds and social, economic, and political frustrations. The fundamentalist had, he continued, reduced the Quran to a case of nauseating anti-Semitism, but it must be admitted, quote, that some Quranic verses, intentionally isolated from their historical context, have contributed even more to the anchoring of anti-Semitic stereotypes in Arab-Muslim mentalities. This petrification of the Arab-Muslim mentality can be reversed, so Haddad, but this would require intellectual audacity, unquote, on the part of Islamic scholars. Again, quoting, since they cannot purge the Quran of its potentially anti-Semitic growths, they must closely examine this corpus with hermeneutical reasoning, unquote. While some Muslims support the universal struggle against anti-Semitism, other Muslims want to prevent any mention, let alone any public discussion, of Islamic anti-Semitism. It is this latter group that has profited at least in the beginning from the actions of Utrecht and Leeds universities. The British historian L.A. Kadoorie, whom I admire a lot, stated that, quote, moral integrity and scholarly vigor were always complementary, unquote, and I subscribe to this point of view. Today, an increasing number of anti-Islamist Muslims are complaining about the well-meaning, unquote, behavior of Western academics, which lacks moral integrity and scholarly vigor. Quote, when Westerners make politically correct excuses for Islamism, states, for example, Tawfiq Hamid, a former member of the Egyptian Islamist organization Gamaa al-Islamiya, it actually endangers the lives of reformers and in many cases has the effect of suppressing their voices, unquote. And he warns that, again quoting, without confronting the ideological roots of Islamism, it will be impossible to combat it, unquote. A reality that not only governments need to get into their heads. Islamism is not motivated by a concept of reason, but by a cult of death. It does not strive for emancipation, but for oppression. It uses the flag of anti-colonialism to promote anti-Semitism. It is true that today, there is no other anti-capitalist or anti-Western movement that is able to mobilize and influence so many people. Bin Laden's latest message builds on this reality, but it is for this very reason all the more essential for every responsible person to draw an inseparable line between a concept of change that is rooted in the traditions of the Enlightenment and emancipation, and a concept of change that is aimed in a fascist way at destroying the development of societies and the freedom of the individual. You can be in favor of or against Islamism and fascism, but you cannot be anti-fascist and pro-Islamist at the same time. Again, I've been reading a lecture given at the University of Leeds on October 10th, 2007, by German author Matthias Kunzel. The lecture's title is Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, The Impact of the Muslim Brotherhood. Dr. Kunzel is also the author of the book Jihad and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. The text of this lecture will be reproduced in its entirety in the description to this broadcast. This concludes For the Record program number 622, update on the Nazi origins of Islamic fascism. This is being recorded on January 27th of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.